Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
There's Eric Zorn, our friend from the Mincing Rascals podcast, longtime Tribune columnist, and now the publisher of something called the Picayune Sentinel, a weekly newsletter. You can sign up for free. Just email ericzorn@gmail.com. Hi, Mr. Zorn. How are you?
I'm good. I'm alarmed at this news about the right turn on red. It seems to me that if you eliminate right turn on red, you're going to increase the number of hours that people have just idling in their cars for no reason at all. And that's bad for the environment. I have never myself caused a problem turning red on red, nor have I even really seen one. And I remember it was probably like 40 years ago that really right turn on red became a thing. And I thought it was a great development, and I still think it's a great thing. And I think that people just need to be a little more careful around these intersections. Maybe if someone messes up a right turn on red and hits somebody or something, that the penalties could increase the way penalties increase when you hit a worker in a working zone, something like that. But it's a real time saver, and you'll come to intersections that are fairly desolate, and there's no reason not to go right on red.
I know. So am I going to be a lawbreaker and just make my ride on red, even though I'm not supposed to, but there's nobody around or not? I don't think I made myself clear a moment ago, but I think you should be able to make a ride on red. I'm for that.
No, if there are no pedestrians around and no bicyclists coming up, I just don't see why it helps anybody to have you sitting there idling in your car. And you think, oh, well, how much time is that per motorist? And it's, you know, maybe not very much time at each intersection, but over time, over the years, you're going to have thousands, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of hours of people sitting there running their internal combustion engines, presumably, at these stoplights with no reason not to turn right on red. I don't know where these initiatives come from. It's like Mayor Johnson had this initiative in his blueprint for Chicago to lower the speed limit on side streets to like 10 miles an hour or something like that. I mean, he's like, what is with this busybody stuff? Where is the problem that he's addressing? And why are we working on this when we've got this migrant challenge facing us right now?
Oh, really? What migrant challenge? I haven't heard about that.
Have you heard? I don't know if you've heard about that, John, but there seems to be 20,000 people in the city, new people in the city, and we don't know where to put them.
Is the most amazing thing about that number the fact that while we have absorbed 20,000 Venezuelans, say, and we don't know where to put them, and we can't come to any kind of agreement with anybody about anything, over almost 30,000 Ukrainians have emigrated to Chicago, and nary a word is heard. 30,000 Ukrainians have moved into the Chicago area, and we've absorbed them.
Monica Ang, our friend Monica Ang over at Axios Chicago, wrote a really good piece about that. And Greg Hines at Cranes just this week wrote a piece about that, so talking about how that is and why that is, and the fact that we do have room in Chicago and we have a need for people in Chicago. And I continue to say that once we get through this particular challenge, that a lot of these people who have braved so much to get here are going to be productive citizens in Chicago. You're going to have, like, you know, the kids who are now living on at police stations on sidewalks are going to be doctors, and they're going to be lawyers, and they're going to be creating art, and they're going to be working in our businesses and factories. And these people are going to contribute to our society, but we have to get through this particular hump right now. That's how I'm looking at it.
Yeah, you and me. Also, you and I have talked about this before, but the suspected Highland Park shooter's father helped him get his Foyd card when that young man was 19 years old, and obviously he killed and wounded a lot of people at the parade on the 4th of July last year. We asked our listeners if we felt 60 days in jail for the dad, that was the agreement that they came to, was appropriate, and 66% said that's not enough of a punishment, 60 days. Where are you on that?
Well, I think that if the crime had been committed while I'm just going to say allegedly here, because we haven't, the son's guilt has not been established.
He reminded me to do that. I keep calling him the Highland Park shooter for shorthand, and I don't want to use the kid's name, but the alleged Highland Park shooter.
Well, let's say the alleged Highland Park shooter, that when the father helped him, and now the father has admitted this in court, that he helped the son buy the gun when the son was 19.
He enabled the kid to buy the gun. The kid legally would not have been able to buy the gun if the dad hadn't signed off.
Right. And then the kid turned 21, and then he was a little bit shy of his 22nd birthday when he allegedly shot up the Highland Park parade. And my question, and the question that I hope would get resolved in court, was when does the father's legal responsibility for his child expire? Does the superseding event of this 21st birthday mean that, you know, the kid could have gone out and bought this gun allegedly used in the shooting on his own without his father's help for 8 or 9 months?
Yeah, I know.
After
I know.
He turned 21.
But evidently, so the strength of that defense, evidently the logic of that defense, this is an adult. He could have got the gun himself. Evidently, the strength of that was not fully appreciated either by the father or maybe their read of the judge, because they said, no, well, we would rather plead guilty than suffer our fate.
Well, he was facing, I think, a maximum of 3 years in prison. This is according to the Sun-Times reporting.
Yeah.
And I think he was looking at the fact that people are up in Lake County, in Highland Park, particularly with Lake County, and in fact, the entire region are furious about what this guy did. I'm furious about it. It was a terrible misjudgment that he made when he bought his son a gun, when his son had talked about suicide, talked about school shootings, and people knew that this kid was trouble, and he helped him buy a gun, and that was a wicked thing to do. It was terrible. If the shooting had happened before the kid was 21, I would say 60 days, it should be, you know, 60 years. I mean, that was a terrible thing. I think a parent should be responsible for that when he's a minor child. When he becomes an adult, that's when the legal question kicks in for me. And that's what I was thinking might get resolved.
Well,
I
wonder if this establishes case law then, since it was a plea agreement. But I'm just wondering if now we've established a precedent here. We have not?
Well, there's no precedent in a plea bargain. And I think when the prosecutor came out and said this creates a beacon for prosecutors all over the country to prosecute mass shooters, the parents of mass shooters, I don't think he did. I think that he pleaded to a misdemeanor. He's going to serve 60 days in jail and do 100 hours of community service. And I think that was nowhere near enough. If we think that he's legally responsible.
Do you wish that they had then not accepted, not made an agreement with the family, but said, no, let's see what happens here. Let's go ahead and let's solve this thing in the courtroom, not outside.
This has all the markings of a civil settlement. It's one of those things where somebody sues somebody and then they say, well, we've reached a settlement, we're moving on. That's kind of how this feels to me. I think that he was afraid that he was going to get convicted, that there's enough anger up there, that no judge or jury was going to let him off, despite what the legal issues might be. I continue to think that he would not, that that conviction would not have survived the appellate process. And when this deal was offered to him, 60 days in jail, and it's like, it's not a bad bargain for him. You're talking about a lot of legal expenses, and he can stand up and say, as his lawyer did, I want to spare the community having to relive the trauma of this event, which I think is just nonsense on his part. I think if he'd wanted to spare the community trauma, he would have made sure his crazy kid didn't get a gun, right? But he did, and I mean, this looks like I think that the prosecutors probably knew that ultimately this would not survive a legal challenge. You can't say that an adult child is a parent's responsibility. I mean, I just don't see it.
Yeah,
I know that, but
you know, the weird thing about that is I appreciate what you're saying. An adult is one thing and a child is another. But you make it sound like there's an off switch, that the instant you turn 21, you're now so mature and so wise. So, you know, you have such sound mind that the parent that gave you the gun the day before should bear no responsibility for that action. There's a continuum of time there that somehow has to come into play. And I just don't buy the fact that because you're suddenly an adult means that there's no connection between how you got the gun and what you did with it afterwards.
There's a moral connection, absolutely, and I think that the father is morally responsible because he knew the kid had a gun, he helped him get the gun, and he should have taken it away from him. He should not have, whether he's 21, 22, whether he's 25, whether he turned 30, if you've got a child living under your roof and you know they've got weapons like that, you've got to get it away from them as a moral matter. As a legal matter, I don't think that you do, but, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I have heard from a number of lawyers who say, yeah, probably was not a really good case, but the father probably realized, you know, this is fighting, this is going to be more trouble, and it's risky that he might have ended up spending more time in jail while his appeals were pending.
Okay, but put it this way, Eric. Suppose it did withstand legal review. What would you think, maybe you can't answer this question, is the appropriate punishment then? Like if the laws or the judge or the jury said, yeah, actually you're going to be responsible for those actions, even though he did it as an adult, what do you think the penalty should be? 60 days?
Well,
I know you can't answer that because you don't think he should be responsible.
But what I can say is if this crime allegedly had been taken place before the boy turned 21,
yeah.
I think 60 years. I mean, I think that responsibility is huge. And there's this case in Detroit, Detroit area with a family that provided the kid with a gun. And I'm blanking on the last name, but it's a case with it's a minor child and he had a gun and he went and did a shooting at a school. I think those parents should pay a stiff price for that. So to me, I mean, it sounds like a real technicality that I'm talking about, but there is a question of the law, of legally, where do we stand on when does a parent stop being responsible for the bad actions of his child?
Okay, hold on right there. It's 11:48 on WGN. And, you know, while you're talking, I'm also thinking about what happened in Lewiston, Maine, and where they have a yellow flag law. The family knew full well that 40-year-old man was a danger to himself and the community. He had been institutionalized for 2 weeks, but they knew well that he was moving guns from a relative's house to his home, maybe 10 or 12 of them. And while they sought to keep him from having access to the guns, or they sought to remove him from the guns by having him institutionalized, they knew there was a problem. Nothing happened. You think, why didn't the family just lock the guns up, throw them away, put them in a storage locker, and don't tell them where it is and hide the key? I mean, could they have? And I'll bet he would have been really mad about that, but too bad. I think it's a very interesting question to start to ask about people who know somebody who has a gun could be a danger, say in Maine or say on the south side of Chicago. Can we, should we, how much responsibility can we hoist on the family members? Eric Zorn, my fellow mincing rascal, and publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, is on a line. Hey, guys, thanks for letting me know that today is the anniversary of the Four Seasons Trump fiasco. My son gave me a Four Seasons T-shirt for Christmas. I wear it proudly today. And somebody else wrote in to say, I want to say hi to Eric Zorn. He interviewed me many years ago when Harmony Inc. sued Harmony International for name infringement. You know, the women's barbershop singers. Eric, do you remember that interview?
I don't, I'm afraid. I wrote close to 5,000 columns when I was at the Tribune, so I tend to, some of them blur together. And that sounds kind of familiar. It sounds like the kind of thing I would have written about.
Well, at the Thomas Jefferson Show, people come up to me and say, I called in that time you were talking about the thing. And I don't want to say I don't remember, but I can't always remember, you know?
Oh. The worst thing that happens to me is they'll come up and go, I really love that column you wrote about, you know, and they'll say something like, they always wear sunscreen. I'll go, no, that was Mary Schmeek. I'll sure pass that along. But we get columnists, we just get confused back when there were a bunch of columnists at the Tribune. But.
Well, you could always just go, yep. And then they made my column into a song and not even address it. Eric, let's just jump to, is a manager worth $8 million a year? What are you talking about there?
They're paying Greg Council $8 million a year. The Cubs are, right. And they fired Rossi. And I took a look online to say, well, what's a good manager worth? And the stat geeks at 538 did an analysis a few years ago. And the sabermetrician people who look at every little possible wrinkle thing. And they see that about most managers are worth about 2 wins per year. If you have a really good manager, you get 2 extra wins a year. And that the players are worth much more in terms of like win a win over. They have this statistic, wins over replacement, mm-hmm. WAR, that statistic, where you have like a good player has, you know, will give you 10 extra wins a year, or a good pitcher will give you 5 extra wins a year. That managers are less important than the players in terms of all these analyses they have. And I guess, you know, a team would want to have, you know, two extra wins could easily put a team into the playoffs and generate some more money. I just can't believe it's worth $8 million a year that you know, you and I could go and pull in relief pitchers and signal for steals and so on. Anyone who knows baseball pretty well could do that. Now, these managers tend to do it better than we do.
I know. I hope they're not looking backwards. The two extra wins would have put the Cubs in the playoffs this year, but you're right. How about this? You got to pay David Ross anyway. You're committed to $40 million for counsel. If you put $40 million in more pitching, that's another way to make the playoffs. And I didn't think David Ross was a bad guy.
No, I thought he was a pretty good manager. I mean, he brought them back from a dismal start. I know they had a bad finish this year and so on. And it always puzzles me when you have a manager like Joe Maddon, say, who was a genius. He took the Cubs and won the World Series in 2016. And then a couple years later, he's a bum and they get rid of him. Why? How could that possibly be? It seems like they just want to shake things up.
Yeah.
And how sensitive are these ball players that they have to have the good clubhouse chemistry to hit a ball and catch it? I really don't understand why clubhouse chemistry is so important to baseball. You're not really this. I mean, yeah, double plays and so on, but there's just not that much teamwork that goes on in baseball. And so they've got to have someone who makes them feel good about themselves or whatever. I don't get it.
Eric Zorn is the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel. You and I will talk about this and other related topics tomorrow in the Mincing Rascals podcast. Thank you, Mr. Zorn.
I will look forward to that. Thank you, John. Talk to you.
As always.